This is George Pelicanis here. I'm the writer of this episode, and I'm here with Joe Chappelle,
the director.
We shot this sometime in the middle of the night, Joe.
Or early morning.
Yeah. And that train that went by was kind of a happy accident.
That was total serendipity. Just happened to be there.
That's far enough.
Now, I wrote this scene quite obviously slowly. To be sort of a Western kind of scene, a face-off between two mythical figures in our show, Brother Buzon and Omar. And then Joe took it and ran with it and actually shot a Western here.
Yeah, I totally embraced the mythic element to it, including, I wanted to introduce Brother Muzon, played by Michael Potts. I didn't want to have him, step into the scene. I just wanted him there, but still give him reveal. So I tried to structure it so we're with Omar, and we hear Muzon off camera, and then he turns, and there he is.
Ain't about to wild out over it.
This dialogue is great, though. We had a cut of this that went on a little bit longer as it exists now. It was kind of fun. But in the interest of making a running time, we had to trim it down.
Resting. I see you favor a 45.
Tonight I do. I keeps one in the chamber in case you pawn.
We were fighting rain this night, too. I think we had we had the wet down, but it was also raining a little bit.
Walther, PPK.
But we had that rain behind him as a trough that we built to sort of enhance that.
As will you, with one in your elbow.
That gun ain't got enough firepower to make my joint.
These guys discussing the guns now, that's sort of a staple of the genre.
You might not hit me.
This range? And this caliber? Even if I miss, I can't miss.
I admire a man with confidence.
I don't see no sweat in your brow neither, bro.
These guys played it great, too.
Now, Joe, you start cutting closer and closer here, right?
I suppose we could stand here.
Well, I wanted to go back just on that little standoff there where the train kind of comes in the distance. Just wanted to pull, keep it close, and then pull back for that moment, and then we go super close for all this.
I want to ask you something, brother.
Omar listening.
George, I know you're a big Magnificent Seven fan. What other Westerns were you thinking of when you wrote that scene?
That was more of a Leone-esque kind of thing, Sergio Leone. The whole thing about two professionals coming together, even into this very tense, volatile situation, and talking about the guns and what the bullets would do and all that sort of, is a pretty cool thing. And it's not just Leone, but it was also, you get that from Ford and Howard Hawks, especially. You look at a movie like Rio Lobo, for example, it's, the bad guy and the good guy are always talking to each other and stuff. So it was an homage to that.
Uh-huh.
At his command, when you don't have the warning, hold on to Jesus' hand.
That's pretty much a tradition that you carry on in your crime stuff, too, right?
Yeah, I love Westerns. The publishers don't really want you to write Westerns anymore, so I do it anyway, under the guise of urban crime fiction. But, this whole idea of the Western where the outsider kind of is in charge of protecting the community is also present in our show here. You got a guy like McNulty who can't fit into anything, not even the institution of marriage. And he's a cop. You know, and that goes back to the sheriff and it's a small town. It's Richard Burton.
Does he work for the mayor's office here?
Yes, he does.
Here we go.
That'd be Shamrock.
Assuming Stringer Bell is the man, now we wait for
my overall strategy with the episode was, since this was 11 out of 12, I approached it as if it was the 11th hour of a 12-hour movie. And so the aim was to sort of direct it, like the whole episode is a climax to the movie.
Maybe we duck the bullet. Maybe we clean this mess quietly. Throw some horseshit at whatever reporter shows up. And the mayor forgives and forgets. Ready to move on this, right?
As soon as we get the word, we shut down all three zones, toss everyone into wagons.
You sort of get the feeling by...
So what the fuck are we waiting on for a day?
The way you've
half?
Directed it and why cut it and so on, that everything's sort of hurtling towards a...
Yeah. It's like events are just, they're in motion now, and they're in flux, and you just really can't stop them. Like, this all falling on Burrell here,
Commissioner
moving
Burrell
here, and he's going right to
I've heard
the mayor's office.
Hold on, Coleman. Come on, let the man talk, huh?
Excuse me, Mayor. I have Commissioner Burrell on the line. He says it's urgent.
I bet it is. He wants to move, Clarence. He wants to clean this shit up yesterday, and so do we.
Tell him to hold. Go ahead, Gene.
Look, I'm not a politician. I'm an academic. All I know is that from a public health perspective, there are remarkable things happening in the free zones. Needle exchanges, on-site blood testing, condom distribution. Most of all, we're interacting with an at-risk community that is...
Like the way this guy looks, he's like one of those crunchy granola types. <show. laughs>
That's the former mayor, Kirk Schmoke of the city.
Kirk Schmoke, yeah, who was... My department sort of crucified in Baltimore for suggesting that one of the options in the drug wars might be
when the story breaks,
just to keep the option open might be a legalization of drugs, and it was pretty much the end of his career. And he's a gentleman and a fine man. You know, we had a lot of good dealings with him on the set.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
We'll use this opportunity to piss on the city from a great height. And Washington, can you imagine how far the United States Department of Justice is going to crawl up your ass behind this?
Crime is down, Odell.
Medical people are telling me this could work. I mean, a 14% decline.
Astute old-time viewers might recognize our mayor going back to Cooley High and J.D.'s Revenge.
Was he in Cornbread Earl and Me Too?
I'm not sure about that.
There's got to be a way. Glenn?
Glenn Turman, yeah.
Hey, Irv, thanks for holding.
Yes, but... Yes, I understand. Then I'll wait to hear from you. We're to hold off on any action in Amsterdam. No arrests, no movement until further notice. He says he wants to regroup. Determine the most effective course of action.
Translate that for me, Irv. I don't speak his fucked up lingo.
Royce is figuring a way to put all...
John Dominic Rawls.
Yeah. Nobody delivers those lines like John. And, you know, the writers fight over scenes to write for this guy because he just brings it, man.
I can spin the story just as well as that motherfucker.
I'd say it's one of the big problems of the show. There's so many good characters, and to fit them all in, it's really hard. And to give them, like, scenes that they can chew into.
Something funny about that?
That's real nice right there.
It's right across from City Hall. The building in the background is City Hall.
You're expecting what?
Payout. A big payout for what we put in, man. Federal dollars.
It was a great episode for Idris. I don't know if he knew it was coming before he got the script.
Yep. To Clay Davis.
He totally embraced it and went for this whole episode. He's great.
You know. What you said? He's running game? Nah, hell no. He ain't that crazy.
Let me guess. He told you about the faucet. Or was it the goose that laid the golden egg?
Well, he shot that. It's almost like he's trapped under there.
Yeah.
And, the vice is starting to tighten up on him.
It is.
Yeah, what office?
He came down to the lobby.
He rain made you. A guy says if you pay him, he can make it rain. You pay him. If and when it rains, he takes the credit. If and when it doesn't... He finds reasons for you to pay him more. Clay Davis, rain major.
No, man. He got them building permits in no time at all, man. I mean, we bribing these motherfuckers. He got the city contractor's money back.
How much?
$35,000 so far.
On $250,000 you gave him.
It's for bribing the motherfuckers.
There are no bribes.
When you guys are beating really these scripts out before we actually shoot them, like, how far in advance did you know, like, where the stringer character's going to go and how it's going to end up for him? Did you know that? Did you guys know, like, at the beginning of the season, or is that something that you kind of, when you're writing it, evolved?
We sort of knew towards the beginning what his fate was going to be this year. But how he got him there was always up in the air, and especially at this point in the season, as you know. I mean, usually the first four episodes are beat out before you start shooting, but it gets tighter and tighter as you go along, and you're actually scrambling to figure all this stuff out as the season progresses, and the pressure is really on. The one difference between writing for television and let's say writing a novel is that you turn the novel in when it's complete, and you can, up until that point that you turn it in, you can go back and change anything. But now you've started to shoot these episodes in television, you've pulled the trigger, and there are a lot of things you can't change. And if you've made some sort of decision that you're not happy with, you got to live with it and then write accordingly for the future episodes.
In this instance, did you find yourselves back in the corner that you had to sort of work around, or that it was just a given, you had to go play out a certain way?
We were just trying to figure out how to get everybody to the finish line. It was very complicated in the show. We were juggling a lot of storylines, obviously. We added the political this year. It was tough, but very rewarding when we got there.
Where are you headed?
Toy store.
Illegalized drugs in special zones?
It's more than that. Major Colvin lost the necessary...
In terms of this scene, I intentionally shot it to sort of mimic how this similar scene was shot in the very first episode of this season, where we started off mastering from across the counter there and then gotten this over these two overs. The difference being I flipped Burrell and Carchetti around in terms of how they sat the table, because they're, in my opinion, their power relationships shift a little bit. So I put Burrell on this side. And once Burrell starts to turn the screws and I just went closer and closer, you'll see we go to this kind of two-shot coming up where we start creeping in. And then when we go back into the overs, we just put this really slow zoom in on both guys as Burrell's making his case to Carchetti.
The mayor says wait.
Why?
I think he's going to make some kind of show.
And it's really, you can see it there. It's really just barely moving in, but it is moving in continuously. With the pressure that my commanders
were getting from City Hall. Now, I've seen your sketches. You, on a scene like this, did you sketch it out first?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really do storyboards, and since where I draw out frames, but what I'll do is I'll get set plans or whatever and do overheads, and like bird's eye view of the where the characters are, where the cameras are, where the camera is in this case, just for the camera. Your pal, Tony, and just sort of map it out, and in that way I can sort of, in my head, I can do like my own paper cut, how I'd cut the scene. It's just a way to make sure I have all the coverage, because, especially in this show, when you guys write stuff in the script, it might seem like an obscure detail or two about a piece of paper or whatever, but it could have huge meaning in terms of the whole season, you know. So it's like I always try to pay attention. I have to read these scripts, you know, as a director, you have to read them over and over again, see really what, make sure you're not missing anything. That's how I prepare for these shows. The great thing about the show and the rewarding thing for director is there's no formula here. You know, you really get to direct and really take these scripts, which have all this multitude of details and backstory, and you try to flesh that out. So for the viewer who's getting really, you're bombarding them with details that you're saying this is the important detail here that you should be paying attention to. Because there are so many characters and there are so many stories and subplots and such.
I doubted you, Tommy.
I told you it was big.
If we play it right.
He wants me to turn the information over to Tony Gray. Let him use it. He figures if Tony's going to be running against the mayor, he'll take aim at Royce and not the department.
We may want to bring Tony in on it. Keep him viable against the mayor. But right now, you need to find out what this is all about. Firsthand. Do you know this Major Colvin?
To shake hands, maybe.
If Burrell is painting him the villain, Colvin might be anxious to tell someone his side of the story.
All right, here's McNulty looking for the trigger fish, and that is novelist Dennis Lehane reading a Stroke magazine, which is not out of character. And Dennis wrote one of the early episodes of this season and did a great job. He, of course, is the author of Mystic River, among many other good books, and great American novelist.
And Listen to Direction, which I loved.
Yes, this is Councilman Crocetti over at the hall. I'm trying to reach Major Colvin.
I'm sorry, but he's on vacation.
I'm aware of that, but I'm trying to reach him on municipal business.
Well, I can put you through his voicemail.
No, not his voicemail. I said I have to reach him immediately.
These aren't easy scenes to act, are they, when you're acting into a telephone?
It's all them. They are not. They are not easy to do.
All right, that's enough. Yeah, I know it hurts. But your fist's gonna be like rocks after a while.
It's great to work with these kids, because a lot of these kids that we cast in this episode, including Justin here, these were not professional actors. We just, you know, while we were in the street shooting, we found them and started them up as background and extras, and then we kind of built them up as we went along. So, and they really are, they did a great job.
Weight on your back foot.
That's right.
Yeah, a lot of these kids just came out of the neighborhoods that we shot in, and they would come over to craft services or whatever and to the Video Village and start talking to us. And then, you know, you saw something in them, and we gave them a shot. And this guy in particular really did great.
Yeah.
Even with this pet, you're going to get trucked. All this stuff falling apart.
See, now, the way that guy's talking, I mean, you cannot cast that guy out of an out-of-town agency. I mean,
no.
It had to be a kid, a real kid.
You know who I am, boy?
And it can be sometimes hard on, like, the, quote, professional actors, you know, who are used to have more formal training to work with the kids who are a little rough. But in this instance, Chad, who plays Cuddy, he totally worked with it and totally worked with them. And really made them better. I think it made him better too.
Now, this guy's playing Slim Charles, talking about a real guy. He's out of D.C. He's sort of a local hero in D.C. He's in a band called Backyard Band Go Go, and he's also got a radio show. He calls himself the Ghetto Prince on PGC on Sunday nights. And you often see this guy around town handing CDs out to kids on the street out of his car and so on. He's a really good guy. And he's turned into a great actor.
Yeah, he's got just a real, his presence is, and his voice, it's really distinct, and it's just fun to watch.
I ain't asking.
Damn, String, I don't know.
Nigga, I got a reminder who the fuck you work for. Hey, I think Slim gonna have to sit this one out, boss. So you finna go hit a state senator now, huh? Yo, you kill a downtown nigga like that, the whole world gonna stand up and take notice. I'm talking about the state police, federals, all of that. You need a dead jackal type motherfucker basically to do some shit like that, not a rubber nigga like Slim.
That nigga took money,
man. I seen it coming.
Well, he gotta go.
Nah, you a fucking businessman. You wanna handle it like that. You don't wanna get all...
Obviously, what we're doing here is we're... You know, showing the rift between these guys, what the mistake that Stringer has made is doing something out of his backyard, whereas Avon is a guy who sees the wisdom in staying in your backyard and doing what you know.
You got a fucking beef with them? That shit is on you.
So, we aimed this at the nearest cell tower. The one that would be the conduit for calls coming to and from our boy Bell.
One thing I learned is that all the technology on the show is true. All the stuff, all the things they talk about happening and stealing, you know, these cell phones and numbers, intercepting calls. That's
Baltimore white pages,
it's all cutting edge, and it's all happening
today. But the
pattern
trace will pull that down. You know, if we know the approximate time of Bell's call, we could start just by pulling calls off that tower at that time.
It could be thousands.
Yeah, well, that's the baseline, but we get a second hit. And that list comes down to dozens.
And after third or fourth.
Then we got his number. You know, I can't believe that this was just sitting over at ISD gathering dust.
Do you guys do the research, George? Or I know Tom Farmer, who's our tech consultant, you know, you work with him a lot in terms of getting information.
Genius.
Basically, I just make stuff up. we needed Farmer on this show because I'm a total, technophobe. I mean, I don't know anything about this stuff. And actually... The whole thing with the cell phones and the burners, the disposable cells, and so on, this was happening in Baltimore while we were writing and shooting this thing, and almost in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was even an article in the New York Times later on saying that some of the drug dealers in New York were copying our show. What they were really doing was copying the Baltimore drug dealers who were ahead of them in this technology.
You should probably sell sweats with hoodies since the season changing and all.
Where you live at?
Here, Bubbles is hooking up with a young guy who's going to be, in a way, his salvation. Something, give him something to stay on the straight a little bit.
Right. Opening up a gym or something.
Yeah, trying to. I'm looking to get up with Avon.
Thought you was out.
Hey, man, that's why I came to you. I mean, I feel like the way we left it, I can't just roll up on him, man, you know?
I know people notice, but that's Bubbles and that kid walking in the background there. Just, again, just keeping everyone in the same world. And even though it's, they don't call much attention to it, a lot of shots like that in the show. Even the background, there could be some significance to the background.
You slam shit like that, you're going to fall out one day.
I'm good.
Trying to school you.
How'd you get that green effect there?
That's just the color of the that curtain. It just cast a glow when it came through it.
It's lit from outside?
Yeah. This was supposed to be a day scene. I think we ran late that day. Right. So this is actually at night. And then the shot coming up where Johnny goes out the window and looks out, that we actually shot that in like 10 o'clock at night or something. But it's a pretty good sheet. And that's, I mean, I hope it looks like day. Every time I see it looks like night to me, but it's supposed to be day. Fighting that a lot, just schedule, trying to make, you know, trying to keep it within the, you know, daylight scenes and daylight, but it, sometimes you just don't, it doesn't quite work out that way.
Yo, I'll get word up, then I'll meet you back.
Shamrock.
4:40 p.m.
The sequence here, I like the sequence just in terms of how it's all kind of laid out in terms of pacing and where we're going in it, because a lot of things are kind of, again, coming together here at once. Again, try to keep the camera moving to keep that feel of the things are just happening.
Now, unless I'm mistaken, I think this was the day that Idris, the actor, played Stringer Bell, Idris Elba, found out that what was going to happen to his character later in the show. And if he looks pissed off, he actually is pissed off, you know. Let's just say he was very surprised. And, you know, to his credit, he came in and did it. I mean, he just did a kick-ass job.
Yeah,
I mean, you can see the emotion on him in this scene.
Yeah, it's me.
Yo, tell him to talk, man. Pick him up. Right.
4:47. 7-minute window.
The reason the actors don't know what's going to happen to them in terms of the show is, our logic is that we don't want them to make that part of their acting. In other words, if they know that they're going to go to jail or they're going to be killed or whatever, it might creep into the performance. And so they get the news pretty close to when we're going to shoot it.
Stay the fuck there, man.
Which can make for some interesting off-screen drama, too.
Yeah.
Jimmy, on the clean phone. He just hit your friend's number, the one off the business card you gave me.
The Western?
His cell. Should we be worried about this?
Boxing gym, huh? Ain't a proper one yet. Why I asked to see you.
And that Western, that's a referral to possibly being Colvin, in terms of that's where the call's coming from. And
I know that's sweet science.
Right.
And I got some kids who are,
but again, in Wire style, it's very underplayed and very
oblique.
Yeah.
These kids gonna get rained on.
I love this scene too.
Headgear, they need guards, cups. You know, so they can take the hit. Sure, you know what I'm saying, man.
Yeah, that's
great. I seen your picture on the Globe posters back in the day.
A little undercard shit, maybe, you know.
Yeah, but still, you was Golden Gloves. For a minute, but I had physical defects. What, you got glass jaw?
Nah, forehead, nigga.
Cranny is shot to do you wrong, man.
Yo, look here, man. You see new heavy bags?
Look. God, he's hustling the hustler, man.
All you gotta do is add water. Then you got speed bag right there, right? Mm-hmm. You got his headgear right here. It's new.
You're a boxer, right, George? Is that what you
I used to do some kickboxing, you know? Yeah. Which is,
now, I know I can go around,
a lot of this stuff was,
collect a dollar here and dollar,
you know, I work
here
with kids and so on. And of course, sports is a way out for a lot of kids and that are in trouble and so on. And I thought a boxing thread in this show would be a good way to show that. And we had a natural built-in thing because Avon was, we had established him as a Golden Gloves guy early in his career.
I'm just saying. There's all sorts of levels.
Now, it seemed like you wrote, even though like you, your name wasn't assigned to an episode, you wrote a lot of the Cuddy scenes over the course of the season.
Right. I mean, we sort of all drifted towards our interests, and what happened was is that you naturally picked up scenes from other episodes. And it wasn't just me. You know, Ed Burns had his particular things that he liked to write, and David liked the politics, Bill Zorzi. So we went to our strengths. And I think it was a good way to do it.
You can go through all that for $10,000? Man, Slim, go get him $15,000 cash, man.
Yo.
Shit. All right, then, man. Hey, you take care of them little niggas, man.
Man, no doubt, bro.
Yeah, that was nice. It gives a dimension to Avon.
Yes.
The fact that he's... And it's a real thing in the city, you know. These, a lot of these guys who you on the surface you think they're bad people, they're actually doing some good things for the community,
right,
too. So it's a
mixed bag.
Yeah. You talk to him?
Fat man,
you good? Hook me up.
Okay, maybe you can talk about this. You did a lot of stuff here, lighting this. And
yeah, this is a great cemetery in the northern part of the city. And I, you know, there's just such a... I don't even know if the scene was written or originally take place in a graveyard. Did we just find the location? You guys put the scene around the location, or...?
Well, we wrote it in a graveyard, but... And then we had second thoughts when we were trying to look for one.
Right.
And we found this good one.
Yeah, your information's good. So we can talk on the real side now, huh?
And for us, it's we kind of took a chance here in terms of being a little bit more, I guess, baroque with the lighting and some of the smoke. A little more, I mean, the show obviously is usually rooted in a very realistic aesthetic, but we kind of went for, you know, playing that up a little, maybe just a little more baroque and, you know, the smoke and the backlighting.
Game over.
A little more dramatic, I guess, than normally you'd see on the show.
So it ain't what
I think it works within the context of what's going on in the scene, and Springer selling out his brother.
But if it keep on like it been.
And then it's also intercut with, you know, the Muzon and Avon sequence in the barbershop.
I stirred up some shit with this Amsterdam mess. That's because you was behind that. That made me come to you with this.
And that's one thing, just by watching the show, you know, these past few seasons, there's a lot of that kind of stuff where there's mirrors, there's scenes that mirror each other frequently within the same episode, if not back-to-back like this. And but again, it's very oblique, very subtle sometimes in terms of how the sequences are mirroring each other. This one, to say, is a little bit more overt in terms of that. But I've seen that a lot.
Yeah.
We got y'all out front. Let's go P-Square.
Now, Joe, you came out of features as well.
For a man who was got shot.
I think this episode, more than any of them we've done, really looks like a...
Who engaged me in the purpose of...
It just looks like
talents.
A feature film. I mean, it's got that quality and...
word was your word. As he represents...
You know, I've worked with a lot of good directors on this show, but I got to say that, Baltimore, you know, you really did a superb job bringing this one in.
Well, thank you, George. That's great. Appreciate that.
Seriously, man.
I have to say, though, Eagle Eagleson, who was the DP these last few episodes of the third season, he did a great job.
The torture of a young boy who was close to Mr. Little's heart. Your man
It was interesting. It took me a while to sort of try to get the right feel between being totally real, or totally natural, in terms of like a documentary style, but also at the same time, the show has never been, like, unlike say the TV show Homicide,
right,
which was total, you know, documentary style handheld. This show has always had a bit more of an elegance to it, I guess, for lack of a better word, but still being natural. So it's a fine line that I've been trying to sort of.
If he made
for myself, discover what's the right amount, what's too stylized, what's not enough. And it's always a back and forth. And I directed an episode the first season. Last year, this season, season three, was my first full season on as a producer. And it took me, I don't even know if I still have figured it out yet, to my own satisfaction, but it's an interesting dynamic, an interesting tension, I think, which kind of comes out in terms of how the scenes come together.
With that alone, you've still got an open line to New York.
So it's not totally raw, but it shouldn't be slick. Which is true about the writing, too, because in some ways it's very street, very real, but at other times it's operatic. Mm-hmm. Which I just find it's just fascinating to watch and listen to. You know, and it's a street drama, yes, but also has the elements of a Greek tragedy.
I could put him in a spot that got heavy artillery. I ain't talking about pistols. I'm talking about mini Tech 9s, shotguns. They even got grenades in that motherfucker.
Yeah, that's automatic fall.
So I'm hoping you can keep that shit to 5. Look, if you hit the joint, these people gonna try and take the rap for it, gonna say all that firepower is theirs. So all you gotta do is just hit them with the parole backup.
Look, I can't make no
promise. I love about the show is the way you guys would.
It's gonna be a nickel.
How sometimes characters who we never saw together at certain points come together at really key important moments.
I'm gonna do my best, all right.
And it doesn't seem arbitrary. I mean, it makes total sense, but it's just, again, it's the city, it's the world. And at moments, like in the opening episodes, you think, well, there's no connection between any of this. But then it all kind of, again, converges, which that's what makes the show so great to watch. Now, did you guys know that it would be, Colvin would be the mechanism that...
No. No, that developed and you know, right down to the wire, we were trying to figure out how to do that. And he actually is he's the guy who also connects to Carchetti. So,
right.
You know, he's the central guy in this season that sort of everything
business
happens because of him, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
And in true Wire fashion, he pays the price for it.
Almost forgot. This came in for you last night. Says she called your cell phone, but you didn't answer. Had a nice voice, like a kitty cat.
We're on.
He said for you to be there half pint.
Yeah, okay.
Right. String a bell. That's him.
There it is.
Yeah, but for how long? He could toss that burner at any moment.
These scenes are always a challenge to direct, where it's like four people looking at a computer screen trying to make that interesting.
Ronnie? Yeah, we're on Stringer's phone.
Lieutenant.
You should go straight to the judge. I'll meet you there with
that. Knocked it down one number.
Lester's raising Daniels.
Knocked his call.
That was pretty cool what you did there, overlapping the
just,
driver.
Just, I think it was a way to help make our running time, too.
Watch that footwork, baby. All right. Take it to him now. Yeah, take it to him now.
This boxing stuff was really well done. This was choreographed by our stunt coordinator, Jeff Gibson. And he worked with these kids. He would basically go off with them and he'd choreograph a dance, in this case boxing. And they would come back on set and they'd be ready to go and they could repeat the same moves over and over and over again. And it just made our lives a lot easier when we were shooting this stuff. You didn't have to, like, discover it.
I met these fellas at that gym over on Pennsylvania Avenue. I'll see if they want to roll through. All right.
You don't return a councilman's calls?
This is the beginning of a new day, and it's going to be a kind of a journey for all these characters. And Colvin is obviously going to take Carchetti on this journey, and then you're going to go back to the gym and see Cuddy ushering these kids into manhood in a way through the boxing.
What did you do, Major? And why the fuck happened to shut it down?
We've seen that law enforcement steamroller approach is just spitting in the wind.
I really think that you're onto something here, Clarence. But if you keep it up, before you know it, they'll be calling you the most dangerous man in America.
Well, I know it may appear that we're vulnerable here, huh? But if we enforce the drug laws everywhere else in the city aggressively, huh? How can they say we're
not? I love that the mayor here is trying to, in his own way, trying to find a way to make it work. You're rooting for him here. You want him to make it work.
Everything upside down.
This used to be one of my worst corners.
This is the neighborhood where a cop got shot last summer, right?
It was Dozerman.
Looks quiet now.
So do most all my corners.
Bob Wisdom is a D.C. guy, grew up in D.C.
G-Man.
He often wears a Redskins hat to the set, which would kind of infuriate all these Ravens fans here, but we didn't care.
So, what's up?
Shut the door. In 10 minutes, we're going to have an affidavit for a city judge to sign. It's for Russell Bell's dirty cell.
It's a good pull.
It is if Bay Wireless doesn't take 5 days to process it. You owe me, Fitz.
Lance Reddick is kind of like our Rock of Gibraltar in this show. He's one of the strongest presences you'll ever find. And he's a really nice guy and off the set, very gentle and loose and so on. But he plays it ramrod straight in the show.
He is intense.
These guys won radio cars 2 months ago. Chasing calls, clearing corners.
This is just for a director and working with an editor. He's in. Totally consistent with all his body moves. Mm. Once he sets it up and does it like in The Master, he repeats it exactly. Which all actors are that way.
Let's go.
And he's totally word perfect. Every time he comes in, he's word perfect. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen him blow a line. And even like in somebody else's coverage.
Affiant or affiant. I've never been clear on that.
And neither of the writers. That's kind of an inside joke. As the word affiant or affiant came up in an earlier season, and nobody could figure out how to pronounce it. So we're still working on it here.
That thing that we did a few years back, was he the...
Yeah.
Was Dunnis done, Jimmy? Now, for your own fucking sake, just let it go.
As well, another thing I love about the show, this is a scene where they're referring to something that happened 2 seasons ago.
Yes. It's an old blood feud here.
Yeah, it's...
And in a way, it's a way to reward the people who have been with us
that's the most
for so long.
Right. Crime in well, it really is, in pays history. Off for that.
We still got some hard-looking boys.
Now, this scene also mirrors a scene from an earlier episode in a community meeting where you saw disgust of the residents and the anger. And now you're seeing the flip side of that, which is these people have now been the beneficiary of Colvin's initiative in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And it's just nice, and we had some good Baltimore actors, especially this woman right here.
Yeah.
The one thing I do miss about my neighborhood, I'm talking about the neighborhood I came up in. See, we knew the police. See, we had a white police officer. Our house was on his beat, on his foot beat. And he would be sitting out talking to my mother damn near every night. I mean, just sitting out on our stoop, just talking. And I'm telling you that this man, his name was Frazier O'Leary. You know, he even knew my grandmother by name.
Yes, ma'am. Let's move on to the tip line information.
I'm so sorry, baby. I'm real sorry, but I was not finished. You see, I'm going to tell you something. I have not seen that face-to-face...
And really, this is just our way of trying to illustrate what has happened to policing because of the drug war.
Right.
And a lot of cops locally and in a lot of other cities that I talk to police think that it has actually ruined modern policing because... In the old days, these guys would become part of the community. They'd be walking their beat. They knew the people. They knew their grandmothers, the kids. And now, because a lot of folks have relatives and friends who have been busted and incarcerated because of these drug laws, the police have become the enemy. And it's an unfortunate byproduct of this drug war.
In terms of your dealings with the cops after the season aired, like in their reaction to the whole concept of Hamsterdam, what have you heard?
Well, I can only tell you that in D.C., I was for 10 years I was trying to get into the homicide squad and roll with those guys and get do my research, and they would never even take my calls or let me through the door. And after this season here aired, they reached out to me and said, we want to talk to you.
Really?
And they felt like this is both the way it was and also with what we were doing, the way it might.
It could be.
It could be, yeah. The
old striker building. Did you take them up on that offer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Last stop
before the cemetery for West. Is that for your new book? Back
when there was still some. Yes, book around. I just completed.
About the time that
now, this anecdote here was something that Ed Burns and I heard. And as soon as Ed and I heard it, we were riding with some cops one night in Baltimore. Yeah, we turned to each other and said, you know, that's going to be in the show.
Didn't know where exactly, but
no.
He would.
And you know, the trick was he going to get it or was I going to get it?
That's sick.
But you know something? I had a lot of respect for that man. Because unlike most folks, I always knew where he stood.
I'm doing my job.
Look, I done showed you the good. Come on, let me show you the ugly.
Another Leone reference there. You can see by the presence of all these people in the office that something's about to go down.
Yeah.
Stringer Bell's given name, Russell. For now, Ahmed.
We're on the top of the mountain.
Is this all done in post, Joe? I can't remember the inserts of the...
The gentleman we referred to earlier, Tom Farmer, our tech guy, who's responsible for creating all the computer graphics, he usually has them available on the day. Because a lot of times we try to, so it's not just straight cutaways of inserts like a computer screen. We try to, right, you know, try to tie them in where we come off the screen and find the character. But usually it's all there. Even like the audio work when they're listening to the phone conversations, that's usually pre-recorded. And we have playback, the actual playback on set, so the actors can play off that.
Now here, Carchetti's going to get his education on Amsterdam, and what I was going for in the script was that you would see this kind of hellish atmosphere through his eyes, and then you took it and ran with it, and so tell us what you did here, to both in terms of your direction and the sound package and all that sort of thing.
Well, the decision was made, to sort of like, we'll just play it all on Carchetti and do it all on the sound, play it all on the cacophony of... the despair would accompany a situation like this. It's also an interesting example of the, being too stylized or, you know, too real, too nuts. Because I also shot a version of these shots when Aiden's walking out in the crowd of, like, I overcranked it. We shot, like, at 40 frames per second, which kind of gave it a little more style, a little more ethereal feel. I felt like he kind of got more in his head. But then once we cut that version together and looked at it, the call was made, well, maybe that's a little too stylized, so we just play it more at the 24 frames, which I still think works really well. I just try to keep it, you know, we're on the super long lens and we're super tight in his face, and adding all these, like, the baby crying and his audio elements, just and hopefully, even though his face, the idea is that his face is registering everything you're hearing and that he's getting the dysfunctionality of it all, as opposed to just going, like, he walks out. Point of view, because we've seen the viewer, I think, by that time, by this episode, seen enough of Amsterdam,
right,
that you didn't have to show it again. The viewer's got it. This is his journey through it, so let's just play it all on him. That was the call there.
A type A, Jimmy. People like me break things. When I slow down or when I take a minute to think about it, I...
Is that your idea of an apology?
I didn't drive an hour up 95 to apologize. I missed you.
This is one of the times McNulty actually steps up and listens to his conscience and does something right.
Not driving back tonight.
That was a good scene for Nama, because he starts off kind of cold to her, and then I think you buy that when he kind of warms up.
So it's
good. And then at the end when he pulls back, he kind of sells it. Could be two tough transitions to make. And he did him pretty well.
How about you? Anything interesting?
I did hear a crazy Baltimore story. You know, through the rumor mill of Washington.
Really?
So some renegade police commander takes it on himself to, I don't know, legalize drugs in the precinct? Mayor doesn't even know about it? Can you believe that?
Crazy story.
Someone, I think it's Colvin. You know him?
It's a nice way you push in there.
Well, I thought, yeah, she crosses the line for him when she mentions Colvin. She brings him up. My feeling was, well, that's when he knows there's something going on. That motivates the moves here.
Water cooler talker down in D.C. knows any Baltimore cop's name.
I was just wondering.
Listen, I'm,
You leaving?
Yeah, I think so.
That's one of those calls, just like that. It's interesting just in terms of when you're putting stuff together. It's like there was the insert of the keys being put down and the insert of the geese being him taking the hand up. And it's it's always those debates I have when I'm putting stuff together. Is that too on the nose? Are we showing? But in this case, it felt right to sort of like that was like when he put him down, then that's when he relaxed. And when he picked him up, that's when he was out of there.
Right.
But normally on this show, it's not a, unlike a lot of network TV shows, which is all where they seem they're all about inserts of one sort or another. This show is not.
But you could have dealt with that shit a little sooner. I mean, yeah, but you know what I'm saying? Don't let it lay on you like that.
This was a great scene, George, the way you wrote it and the way these guys played it.
Enjoy this view.
In the view.
Thank you. Yeah, I think this is, of all my work on The Wire, I'm most proud of this scene.
Yeah, you should be.
And of course, you know, it's not just me, it's the actors, it's the direction, it's everybody that worked on this, but it just really, it just really came together, man.
Yeah.
True. And then there was that one time, nigga.
Toy store?
Hell yeah, I told your ass not to steal a badminton set. What you gonna do with a fucking net and a racket? And we ain't got no yard. He's like, yo, that white boy ain't gonna jump over that counter and come chase after me.
He sure did, though.
And he said, whoo.
I said, what the
fuck? He was on your ass like Carl Lewis. Fist was balled up. Your ass was running.
After we did a few takes, and these two guys loosened up, it was
just
kind of flowed.
Of course, the viewer knows that they have betrayed each other. And it just lends a lot of weight to the scene.
Man, if I had the money that I have now, man, I could have bought half this waterfront property. God damn it.
But again, the rift is still there because they both have different perspectives on this thing.
Just dream with me. We ain't got a dream no more, man. We got real shit. Real estate.
And they're both right, which is the other thing, too.
Yes. It's two halves of one man.
Yeah.
I can't get too fucked up tonight, man. I got some shit I gotta do over inside tomorrow. Plus, that fucking Polak, we got work before us, man. I gotta pull his coat.
That's a long lens. That's why everything's blown.
Yeah, it's like running on 250 millimeter. And then we went really for these key moments here at the end. We went really, really tight on these guys. And I just love the way the lights bloom behind them.
What time? 12. I think. Well, you need me to do something for you? I'm just seeing where you're
going. Your depth of field is so narrow here, but it's all about their faces and that glow behind them.
You need to relax more, man.
And it pulls back out.
Time is right. I will. You know I don't take my work too seriously.
That's right.
It's just business.
I just always loved that look. I mean, when he looks on that line.
Us, motherfucker. Us, man.
Great moment. Of course, they had said that when Avon was in prison, they'd put their fists up to the glass and said us. It was their bonding words.
This is a great thing about the show is like this next shot here, we can just let this play out. Or a lot, most things you have to get out. You don't have the luxury of letting a moment like this sort of hang. Just let it sit, let the moment sit there. I mean, it's great.
Oh,
Now, these little guys in these scenes are real Baltimore boxers. We found them a couple gyms. One of them's, of course, the Mac Lewis gym.
These are the same kids we saw, like, I'm not sure, episode 9 or whatever it was, when Cuddy went to that gym, right? Yes. They were sparring in the in the ring.
Come on, boy, I'm calling your name. All right, listen up. We're going to have 3 2-minute rounds. Watch the low blows, touch gloves.
This great handheld stuff in here. Eagle, we mentioned earlier, our DP, had like to configure a special camera so he could just cradle it and get right in the ring with the kids. I feel bad for Justin, who's the tall kid in the ring there, because we had to do this a few times, and he basically had to get beaten for half a day.
Yeah, that little guy was really hit.
He was hanging back.
That was a quick 2 minutes.
Yeah, I know. You water boy and spit it out.
You all right?
Dizzy.
That's why the hell I keep telling you got to breathe, boy. So what? You had enough?
No, I'm good.
All right. All right.
I think in another kind of show, this guy would... Justin would, you know, win this fight.
Of course.
And well, all we wanted to do was show that, you know, baby steps, just stay in the ring. Mm-hmm. These small steps are a kind of triumph
right.
in this world.
No, that's exactly right. He just gutted it out was his triumph.
Hey, we're up. Here it is.
Me, man. You're from the Fat Man. Yeah. We low, right? On the mark side of the mark.
Yeah, it's like Tracy, it's like.
I told the man I'm doing what needs done.
Aye, I tell him. Oh, and that other thing?
That's Richard Burton again on the vocals. We could not the Richard Burton. We couldn't get him, but we got the Baltimore version.
Not the Welsh one.
There you go, even Lance is smiling.
Yeah, that's 3 years of work right there. Even he's got to smile at that.
I guess this is pertinent. Yeah.
Still some tension, though, between those two. That's a good beat, too, where the kid thinks that he maybe has had too much, and then Cuddy says, keep it on.
Chad Coleman as Cuddy was a real find this year. He's a guy who, you look at him and he acts with his eyes, as many of the great ones did, Lee Marvin, Steve McQueen. You know, you don't have to do too much with a guy like that. And he was just, he made Cuddy, man.
Yeah, he did. This one shot here is an example of us having to compromise a little bit at the end of our day. We were rushing to get this, and normally there's a much more elaborate setup. But
is there an alley entrance?
We're losing daylight.
Boarded up on both sides, so we're going to have to go through the front.
That's a change for you, isn't it?
That's a great line, too.
Just sorry. Ready, both sides. Now I'm talking about.
So now you got the two, you got the two gunfighters together.
Breathe, boy, breathe.
Joe did extensive work on this climatic scene in this warehouse. It was totally choreographed and sketched out and so on, and it shows.
Yeah, we took probably an inordinate amount of time to do the coming up, the shooting of Stringer, but we planned that going in because we're paying off really 3 years of work, so we wanted to do it right. Done for the day. And it took a long time, but I think it was worth it.
Oh, I can see it all clearly now. Between you and them subcontractors and that motherfucking politician, y'all had me in a spin, right?
Mr. Bell, I don't know.
Little man! We gonna get all this shit sorted out. And hey, if the shit don't come up right, one way or another, you gonna pay for the shit.
Look, I understand you're angry, but at the same time, you can see the progress we've made in here.
Progress.
Now, I honestly don't know what passed between you and Senator Davis. But if you're unhappy with Clayton's performance, then you have to work that out.
There you go.
Shit. Oh, God. Oh, God. No.
I mean, this is a scene on another show or even a movie. There'd be music blaring here, but I think it's that much colder when it just plays as is.
Yep.
I love that shot, him just coming down there. The pigeons did what we wanted them to do, which was scripted.
Nice.
I ain't strapped. Look, man. I ain't involved. I ain't involved in that gangster bullshit no more. What y'all niggas want, man? Huh? Money? Is that it?
Remember we gave Michael Williams, who plays Omar, some extra sweat on this because I think the idea is when he goes into battle or combat, we always glisten him up.
Right.
Huh. A little more than normal.
It ain't about your money,
he
bro.
He just kind of shines there. It's great.
Your boy gave you up. That's right. And we ain't had to torture his ass neither.
He's talking, referring to his old, former boyfriend who was right. Tortured by these guys.
I just love the way he accepts this here.
It seemed like...
Yeah, he stands tall.
Yeah.
Don't say nothing to change your minds. Well, get on with it, motherfucker.
It was hard to lose Idris, you know, not just because, you know, he's such an emblematic guy on the show. He's also... you know, we liked him as a man and so on, but we're confident that he's going to do all right out there. This is a guy who has potential to be a movie star.
Oh, yeah, he definitely has the charisma for it.
And there's the end of the dream there.
Yeah. And again, we just get to linger on this last image, which is great that we don't have to cut out real fast.
Go. Good work, Joe.
You too, George, and congratulations on your Emmy nomination for writing this episode.
Thanks, man.
Good work.